A young and keen curate would be most likely to ignore the cutting wind and the rain and conduct the service in a reverent and unhurried way, but an elderly parson would rattle through as fast as he could to get out of the cold and back to his Idiaresis negation reside. I was hoping like mad for an old man and a quick farewell to the departed. My luck was in, and the aged clergyman who turned up with the cortege rattled through the proceedings with great speed and was off like a shot. After the mourners had gone, we began to fill in the new grave, a deep one intended in due course to hold three coffins. Our first task was to withdraw the cords which had lowered the coffin into the grave, but on this occasion one of the cords had stuck and we couldn't shift it for all our tugging. So, since I was the youngest, the smallest and the lightest of all the cemetery gardeners, I had to climb down a ladder into the grave and stand on the lid of the coffin to help to free the cord. I must confess the task distressed me, but it was part of my job and I had to do it. Maybe I did it too well, for from that day on, whenever a coffin got jammed or a cord trapped, invariably I was the unfortunate junior who was summoned to perform this horrid operation. There were other chores in the cemetery which I found distasteful, even frightening, such as the times when an unusual number of people died in winter or during an epidemic, and we would be so busy during the day we had to fill in the new graves at night by the flickering light of lanterns. I found this eerie and melancholy work, even more so on the occasions when I had to get down into a grave to perform my hated speciality of disentangling coffin cords. I was 15 in the summer of 1926, and I was beginning to wonder whether, if I learned all I could from the senior gardeners about the care of plants and flowers, I might one day escape from the sadness of the cemetery to work in the grounds of some gentleman's country mansion. Pursuing this ambition, I made myself very unpopular by badgering the gardeners for information about their work and following them about while they did it. One hot August day that year, the world learned with stunned disbelief that the actor Rudolf Valentino had died suddenly in New York at the age of 31. Millions had adored this man, and the wave of shock and grief seemed to travel right around the globe. In my small comer, I also grieved for his death and found the world a sadder place because of it. How could I guess that far off in the future I would be more friendly with Valentino when he was dead than I ever could have been had he lived? 2. Tactfully out of sight behind a yew hedge in the cemetery, was a potting shed where the gardeners ate their sandwiches, brewed tea and talked during the midday break. Mr. Hobbs, my immediate boss, enjoyed laying down the law on any and every subject, and it was his voice, gritty as a gravel path, which dominated these sessions. He was a lean and weathered man with a habit of shaking his bony forefinger, deeply stained by nicotine, at whoever he harangued. He was supposed to be a great reader, which gave him the edge in an argument, as invariably he quoted some book he claimed to have read to contradict any opinion but his own. As the rest of us read only sports results or, in my case, magazines about the Hollywood stars, Mr. Hobbs had become something of an oracle. Once a mild little man called Carter was telling us about his conversion at a Salvation Army meeting, and I could not help being struck by the way his face lit up when he spoke of the joy he felt when he knew he was saved. But Mr. Hobbs would have none of it. He shook his bony finger in Mr. Carter's face and grated scornfully, "You want to read your Darwin, mate? He showed up that rubbish for a pack of lies years ago." Clearly Mr. Carter had never heard of Darwin, and so Mr. Hobbs was able to expound his version of the theory of natural selection. But Mr. Carter refused to be blinded by science. "I happen to believe that if we live decent lives here below, we shall go to our reward in the hereafter," he said stoutly. Mr. Hobbs got quite worked up. "Haven't I just been telling you there isn't any hereafter? It's all evolution. First we was Idiaresis negation sh, then we was apes, and now we are human beings, and when we kick the bucket will be compost for the roses in some graveyard, and that is absolutely all there is to it." I was the youngest of the gardeners and shy about butting in on my elders, but I hated to see the light go out in little Mr. Carter's face, and timidly I tried to support him by telling about the time I saw my Uncle Alf in our kitchen after he was killed. Mr. Hobbs snorted. "It was in your mind, boy. You was thinking about the deceased and you imagined you saw him. Hypnotized yourself into it most likely. Made bold by a grateful look from Mr. Carter, I persisted. I never saw Uncle Alf in my whole life, so how could I imagine him? I didn't even know who he was until my Aunt Nell showed me the photo she found in his kit bag. Mr. Hobbs fixed me with his washed-out blue eyes, tapped his forehead with a bony finger. Take my tip, young fella me lad. Don't you go telling them tales to anyone in the medical profession or you'll find yourself inside Shelley Asylum before you're very much older. The eyes and the finger were too much for me. No, Mr. Hobbs, I said meekly. At 17 I had been concerned with life, with earning my living, growing up, enjoying such pleasures as came my way, and I had not given much thought to the question of life after death. But the incident in the potting shed made me think seriously about such matters for the first time. Admittedly, working in the cemetery gave me the impression death was a pretty final event. When the mourners had gone and the earth was filled in and pressed down on the new grave, I knew very well the corpse underneath had already begun to decompose, so the resurrection when Gabriel blew his silver trumpet on the last day seemed an impossible lie. Was Mr. Hobbs right? Were we just apes who had learned to be smarter than our forebears who lived in trees? Was our universe a cosmic accident doomed eventually to total extinction? What then was the conviction which gave timid Mr. Carter his inner glow and gave him the courage to stand up to the formidable Mr. Hobbs? I thought about seeing Uncle Alf and Mrs. Pugh when I was a child. They had not struck me at the time as being anything but ordinary living people, yet they were dead and Mrs. Pugh's body, at least, must have been far advanced in decay. Had I really seen them or was I heading for the asylum, as Mr. Hobbs seemed to think? For days on end I pondered these and other questions, wondering where I could go or whom I could find to give me the answers. It began to seem to me that the most important thing in life was to know the meaning of death. I started to haunt the local churches. Every week I went from one to another hoping to find some clue, some grain of truth in which I could believe. But just like Omar K. inverted exclamation mark M, I heard great argument but evermore came out by the same door as in I went. I wanted so much more than the churches could offer. I was not content to have faith in or to hope for. I wanted to know. I needed some conviction on which to build my life. If death meant oblivion, I could accept that, even without regret, but I wanted to be certain. If there was a life after death, I wanted proof of it and I wanted to know what kind of life it would be. After many weeks of earnest seeking in the various denominations of the Christian Church, I had found neither conviction nor any hope of it and I was beginning to despair. I read a notice in the local library about a meeting of the Theosophical Society. Someone was going to address them on the ancient wisdom. This seemed right up my street, for what was I looking for if it were not wisdom? I borrowed a dictionary from the library to look up the word theosophical and I was thrilled to read theosophy was immediate divine illumination claimed to be possessed by specially gifted persons. I could hardly wait for the night of that meeting. There were very few people in the audience on the big night and I felt sorry for the speaker who had come up from London for the occasion, so when he stepped onto the rostrum I kept on clapping long after everyone else had stopped, to make him feel welcome. He spoke in what I thought of as a haw-haw voice and used words I had never heard before, so I thought he must be very educated and as he was also specially gifted, according to the Chambers Dictionary, I prepared to drink in his every word. Unfortunately, most of his discourse passed right over my devoted head. He had a lot to say about astral bodies, but he did not bother to explain what they were. Things were looking up when he began to talk about souls who had progressed spiritually on the other side who would sometimes reincarnate back into earthly bodies to perform some special work. This seemed hopeful. At least this educated, specially gifted man was taking it for granted there was another side. Then came a real shot in the arm. The speaker solemnly warned the audience to have nothing to do with spiritualist mediums who, when they got in touch with the dead, contacted only entities who were unevolved and were just hanging about the earth and the low vibrations they brought with them were not helpful. This was the first time I had ever heard it was possible to get in touch with the dead, and I was thrilled at the very idea. If it were true, then whatever kind of entity one contacted, high vibrations or low, it would surely prove there was life after death, or so at any rate I reasoned at the time. Obviously my next step was to find these spiritualists with their low vibrations, whatever that meant, to see what I could learn from them. I kept asking people where I could find them, but no one seemed to know. Sometimes the people I asked acted strangely. They turned on their heels and stalked away looking affronted, or else they screwed a finger into their temple and gave me a pitying look. I began to think I was trailing some sinister secret society. By the 1970s, spiritualism was respectably and officially a religion with some 3 million adherents in the UK, but back in those days mediums still risked prosecution under the Witchcraft Act of 1735, and to a certain extent they were driven underground. I did not know this at the time, of course, and I concluded I had reached another dead end. Some weeks after I had more or less given up the search for these elusive spiritualists, I had been given the task of tidying up a row of contract graves, so named because relatives paid the cemetery a fixed sum every year for their upkeep. When I had finished, I noticed a neglected, overgrown grave beyond them. I felt sad for this unknown, for whom no one seemed to care, and decided I had enough time before the midday break to tidy him up. I was busy clipping away the long grass and weeds on this forlorn grave when a woman walked up the path carrying a sheaf of fresh flowers. She removed the flowers from the grave she was visiting, which, to my uncritical eye, seemed almost fresh, and threw them in a refuse bin, then put her fresh flowers on the grave and went away. By this time my efforts had uncovered the name on the headstone of the sad grave I was working on, and I saw the man buried there had once been known as Edwin Lewis. With a shock of recognition I studied the dates on the headstone, and I was left in no doubt that this was the grave of my dear Mr. Lewis, the teacher who had believed I might one day become an artist. The grave was as spick and span as I could make it, so I retrieved the woman's almost new flowers from the bin, shook them out and tidied them up as best I could, put them into a jam jar and placed them on Mr. Lewis' grave with a small prayer for his happiness wherever he might be. As I sat in a corner of the potting shed eating my lunch, I could hear Mr. Hobbs' voice rasping above the rest as usual. And so I said to the missus, it's a lot of bloody nonsense. I've been burying stiffs for 30 years, I said, and believe me, they stay buried. How can they come back? Them spiritualists are after your money, you silly cow. I almost choked on my idiosis negation sh paste sandwich. Mr. Hobbs grated on. What's more, I said to her, if you set foot in that Quaker's Hall tonight to try calling up the departed, your hat with the grapes on it will go into the idiosis negation re. Any sympathy I had for Mrs. Hobbs was quickly drowned by my excitement. At last I had a clue to finding the elusive spiritualists. Come what may, I would be at the Quaker's Hall that night. Scrubbed and wearing my Sunday suit, I arrived at the Quaker's Hall and read a handwritten notice outside which said there would be a spiritualist service that evening with Mrs. Annie Johnson, the well-known trance medium, giving an address followed by clairvoyance. Trance? Clairvoyance? Well, there was only one way to find out. I went inside. The hall was only half filled, and I decided to sit in the back row as near to an exit as I could get, in case I wanted to beat a hasty retreat before the proceedings were over. Gradually the hall filled up and hymn books were handed out. On the cover of mine I read the Greater World Christian Spiritualist Hymn Book. Ah! I thought, so they are Christians, are they? But, looking about me, I didn't think there was much of a church atmosphere about this bare hall. People were chatting, even laughing together, and there were none of the church ornaments I had been accustomed to admire during my months of perambulation around other Christian churches in search of truth. When the service started, I was even less impressed. It seemed a haphazard business. I considered it lacked the professional touch. In fact, I felt somewhat superior to these simple folk who sang hymns that I did not know, to a wheezy old harmonium, and who prayed in an almost chatty way, as if they were talking to the Almighty on friendly terms. It seemed presumptuous to me. This is the worst service I've been to yet, I thought. Suddenly there was a stir and a rustle among the congregation as a man and a woman walked together down the aisle towards a platform at the front end of the hall. They sat down on two straight-backed chairs facing us. Argument but have more came out by the same door as in I went. I wanted so much more than the churches could offer. I was not content to have faith in or to hope for. I wanted to know. I needed some conviction on which to build my life. If death meant oblivion, I could accept that, even without regret, but I wanted to be certain. If there was a life after death, I wanted proof of it, and I wanted to know what kind of life it would be. After many weeks of earnest seeking in the various denominations of the Christian Church, I had found neither conviction nor any hope of it, and I was beginning to despair. I read a notice in the local library about a meeting of the Theosophical Society. Someone was going to address them on the ancient wisdom. This seemed right up my street, for what was I looking for if it were not wisdom? I borrowed a dictionary from the library to look up the word theosophical, and I was thrilled to read theosophy was immediate divine illumination claimed to be possessed by specially gifted persons. I could hardly wait for the night of that meeting. There were very few people in the audience on the big night, and I felt sorry for the speaker who had come up from London for the occasion, so when he stepped onto the rostrum I kept on clapping long after everyone else had stopped, to make him feel welcome. He spoke in what I thought of as a haw-haw voice and used words I had never heard before, so I thought he must be very educated, and as he was also specially gifted, according to the Chambers Dictionary, I prepared to drink in his every word. Unfortunately, most of his discourse passed right over my devoted head. He had a lot to say about astral bodies, but he did not bother to explain what they were. Things were looking up when he began to talk about souls who had progressed spiritually on the other side, who would sometimes reincarnate back into earthly bodies to perform some special work. This seemed hopeful. At least this educated, specially gifted man was taking it for granted there was another side. Then came a real shot in the arm. The speaker solemnly warned the audience to have nothing to do with spiritualist mediums who, when they got in touch with the dead, contacted only entities who were unevolved and were just hanging about the earth, and the low vibrations they brought with them were not helpful. This was the first time I had ever heard it was possible to get in touch with the dead, and I was thrilled at the very idea. If it were true, then whatever kind of entity one contacted, high vibrations or low, it would surely prove there was life after death, or so at any rate I reasoned at the time. Obviously my next step was to find these spiritualists with their low vibrations, whatever that meant, to see what I could learn from them. I kept asking people where I could find them, but no one seemed to know. Sometimes the people I asked acted strangely. They turned on their heels and stalked away looking affronted, or else they screwed a finger into their temple and gave me a pitying look. I began to think I was trailing some sinister secret society. By the 1970s, spiritualism was respectably and officially a religion with some 3 million adherents in the UK, but back in those days mediums still risked prosecution under the Witchcraft Act of 1735, and to a certain extent they were driven underground. I did not know this at the time, of course, and I concluded I had reached another dead end. Some weeks after I had more or less given up the search for these elusive spiritualists, I had been given the task of tidying up a row of contract graves, so named because relatives paid the cemetery a fixed sum every year for their upkeep. When I had finished, I noticed a neglected, overgrown grave beyond them. I felt sad for this unknown, for whom no one seemed to care, and decided I had enough time before the midday break to tidy him up. I was busy clipping away the long grass and weeds on this forlorn grave when a woman walked up the path carrying a sheaf of fresh flowers. She removed the flowers from the grave she was visiting, which, to my uncritical eye, seemed almost fresh, and threw them in a refuse bin, then put her fresh flowers on the grave and went away. By this time my efforts had uncovered the name on the headstone of the sad grave I was working on, and I saw the man buried there had once been known as Edwin Lewis. With a shock of recognition I studied the dates on the headstone, and I was left in no doubt that this was the grave of my dear Mr. Lewis, the teacher who had believed I might one day become an artist. The grave was as spick and span as I could make it, so I retrieved the woman's almost new flowers from the bin, shook them out and tidied them up as best I could, put them into a jam jar and placed them on Mr. Lewis' grave with a small prayer for his happiness wherever he might be. As I sat in a corner of the potting shed eating my lunch, I could hear Mr. Hobbs' voice rasping above the rest as usual. And so I said to the missus, I said, "It's a lot of bloody nonsense. I've been burying stiffs for 30 years, I said, "and believe me, they stay buried. How can they come back? Them spiritualists are after your money, you silly cow." I almost choked on my I diuresis negation sh paste sandwich. Mr. Hobbs grated on. "What's more," I said to her, "if you set foot in that Quaker's hall tonight to try calling up the departed, your hat with the grapes on it will go into the I diuresis negation re." Any sympathy I had for Mrs. Hobbs was quickly drowned by my excitement. At last I had a clue to finding the elusive spiritualists. Come what may, I would be at the Quaker's Hall that night. Scrubbed and wearing my Sunday suit, I arrived at the Quaker's Hall and read a handwritten notice outside which said there would be a spiritualist service that evening with Mrs. Annie Johnson, the well-known trance medium, giving an address followed by clairvoyance. Trance? Clairvoyance? Well, there was only one way to find out. I went inside. The hall was only half filled, and I decided to sit in the back row as near to an exit as I could get, in case I wanted to beat a hasty retreat before the proceedings were over. Gradually the hall filled up and hymn books were handed out. On the cover of mine I read the Greater World Christian Spiritualist Hymn Book. Ah! I thought, so they are Christians, are they? But, looking about me, I didn't think there was much of a church atmosphere about this bare hall. People were chatting, even laughing together, and there were none of the church ornaments I had been accustomed to admire during my months of perambulation around other Christian churches in search of truth. When the service started I was even less impressed. It seemed a haphazard business. I considered it lacked the professional touch. In fact, I felt somewhat superior to these simple folk who sang hymns that I did not know to a wheezy old harmonium and who prayed in an almost chatty way, as if they were talking to the Almighty on friendly terms. It seemed presumptuous to me. This is the worst service I've been to yet, I thought. Suddenly there was a stir and a rustle among the congregation as a man and a woman walked together down the aisle towards a platform at the front end of the hall. They sat down on two straight-backed chairs facing us. The man was small, drooping and elderly. Irresistibly he reminded me of pictures I had seen of the notorious Dr. Crippen who, before I was born, had chopped up his wife and eloped with his typist. The woman was imposingly dressed in purple with a large silver pectoral cross. I approved of the cross. It gave a touch of authenticity to the proceedings. Dr. Crippen got to his feet and said one of the chatty prayers, then he invited us to sing another hymn. During the singing I observed my purple lady dropping off to sleep. After the hymn, Crippen announced that Mrs. Annie Johnson would now give her trance address. So my purple lady was the medium, but didn't silly Dr. Crippen know she had fallen asleep? To my astonishment the sleeping woman stood up and began to speak. I sat up with a jerk at the first words, for booming through the hall there came, from the lips of this sleeping woman, a voice no lady had any right to have. It was a deep, resonant, cultured voice, unmistakably male. Could it possibly be a man dressed up as a woman, I wondered? Would anyone dare to do such a thing in a Christian church? But no one in my vicinity seemed perturbed or even surprised. They were listening intently to what was being said. So I stopped worrying about it and began to pay attention. The talk was about the life eternal. The male voice coming through the lips of Mrs. Johnson said he loved to come back to earth to comfort those who were grieving for the physical loss of their loved ones, to assure them the dear ones were only lost to human sight. We were informed that they were still living, still loving those left behind them, and from the happier world where they were now they could sometimes send messages of love and hope to those on earth. Tonight he told us he was going to help some of those who had gone before to give messages to their friends present in the hall. To put it mildly, I was staggered. Was this woman, or was it a man, proposing to call up the dead? I remembered the warnings at the Theosophist meeting about dangers of low vibrations, and wondered if I should leave before this part of the program began. But in for a penny, in for a pound, I told myself and sat tight. The medium sat down and Dr. Crippen invited us to sing a hymn called Silently Now, We Wait for Thee. During the singing I wondered just what they were waiting for and had I been wise to decide to remain, but I did not want to push past the row of women between me and the exit, so more from shyness than conviction I stayed and sang with the rest. The hymn ended and we all sat down. Mrs. Johnson walked to the edge of the platform and pointed to a woman near the front of the congregation and began to speak to her in a quiet, pleasantly feminine voice, totally unlike the one she had used when she was asleep. She told the woman her husband was standing beside her and he was anxious for the woman to know he no longer had the terrible pain in his chest from which he suffered before he passed away. Mrs. Johnson described their husband, even down to the color of his suit and club tie she said he was wearing. The woman accepted what she said with an emphatic nodding of her head. I strained my eyes trying to see this man Mrs. Johnson said was standing beside the woman, but I could see neither hide nor hair of him, so I concluded this was some kind of act cooked up by the pair of them, which did not impress me. There were other messages of a similar nature for other people in the hall and one or two grew very emotional as they accepted what Mrs. Johnson was telling them as true. I was still convinced that Mrs. Johnson was working with accomplices planted in the congregation. I want to speak to the young man in the back row, said Mrs. Johnson suddenly and pointed straight at me. I was petri dieresis negation ed at being singled out and looked around helpfully to see if there was another young man she might mean, but I was the only male in the whole row and the finger continued to point at me. Put up your hand, young man, said Mrs. Johnson, so very nervously I raised my arm. Yes, she said, I mean you. There is a man here who wants to thank you for the flowers you put on his grave this morning. He tells me he was a schoolmaster and his name was Edwin Lewis. Do you understand this? I was flabbergasted, but Mrs. Johnson was not finished with me. She went on to give an accurate description of Mr. Lewis as I remembered him and said he had been interested in my drawing and painting when he was on Earth. He was given a military funeral, she added casually. By this time I was very hot under the collar. How could this woman whom I had never seen in my life, who could not possibly know anything about me, tell me about a man I had known in my childhood and describe what I had done that morning, when I had been entirely alone at Mr. Lewis' grave. But Mrs. Johnson was not done with me even yet. She described other people she said she could see around me, including an Arab. What was an Arab doing around me, I wondered? What did he want with me? He was a guide, said Mrs. Johnson, and he was not really an Arab. He was someone who dressed as an Arab. This seemed to me to get more involved by the minute. When Mrs. Johnson finally told me that this young Arab, who wasn't an Arab, wanted me to develop as a medium to be of service to humanity, I thought she was well off the mark. In the not too distant future, Mrs. Johnson insisted, you will be doing the same kind of work as I am doing and you will become a very famous medium. This seemed so crazy and so impossible I shrugged it off and crept out of the hall as unobtrusively as I could. For a long time before I slept that night I turned these events over and over and over again in my mind and the more I thought about what Mrs. Johnson had told me, the more fantastic it seemed. I could no longer believe it was a trick played with the help of people planted in the congregation, because it had happened to me. No one but I could have known what I had done when I was entirely alone, with not another soul in sight, at Mr. Lewis' grave, nor could Mrs. Johnson have known of his special interest in me or of my affection for him. It had all happened when I was very young, and I was not a child who discussed my innermost feelings with others. Even my grandmother had no idea of the depth of affection the love-starved child I was had felt for Mr. Lewis. I remembered the dead people I had seen in my childhood who had vanished so abruptly when I approached them, and I felt these incidents tied up in some way with the things Mrs. Johnson had said to me and to the others in the hall. Yet I still doubted. I could not quite accept that the dead could or would come back, from wherever they might be, into the bare Quaker Hall to relay messages to their friends through a lady as solid and earthly as Mrs. Johnson.